Good evening and welcome to a potpourri of King Records topics in honor of the 75th anniversary of King Records this month. During the next hour, you'll hear an interview by Dellen Stokesbury with a researcher on his work about the Tokyo Happy Coats. Frank Johnson speaks with Darren Blaze about his King Records displays at Shake It Records. Paul Muller previews the Cincinnati Preservation Fall Forum Luncheon and their look at King Records. Playwright K.J. Sanchez and music director Richard Huntley discuss the upcoming Cincinnati King production at Playhouse in the Park, and Tim Reardon shares his thoughts on the preservation efforts of the King Records studio on Brewster Avenue. I'm Lee Hay, and this is a King Records Potpourri special on WBXU.
My name is Roy Balker, and I've been researching the history of the Tokyo Happy Coats, which was a band that formed in the 1950s in Japan and then later came to the United States. And I've been researching them for almost 2 years.
Do you know about how long Tokyo Happy Coats were signed to King Records?
The history of the Tokyo Happy Coats, their relationship with King Records, started actually in 1969. There was a gentleman by the name of Leonard Bob Marsano of Berkeley, Michigan. He signed the band to a recording contract through his music company, which was called Astrosonic Production. At some point, Astrosonic connected with Starday King Records of Nashville. And if you remember, Starday King was the one that owned King Records at that time. Starday King eventually recorded and released the Tokyo Happy Coats' records on the King label.
How did you first encounter Tokyo Happy Coats music?
I learned about the band about October 2015. I was on YouTube and I came across this video, but it was one of those videos that just posted the audio of their song, He Don't Love Me Anymore. I heard it and I was like, this is a catchy song. I sort of like it. And then in the video, it sort of had pictures of the band and, of course, their name and the look sort of intrigued me. Then shortly thereafter, I started buying their vinyl records. As far as I know, back then, that was the only way that you could get their music. So about a month later that year, I bought their first record of theirs, Forevermore. And then over time, I picked up other records of theirs. Now, in October of 2016, I began the earnest research on the band. You know, when you would try to look up things on the internet about them, you couldn't find a whole lot. A couple blog posts, but nothing real definitive. So I was able to search and compile magazine and newspaper articles about them. But then about November of 2017, I started trying to find primary resources. I started looking for the sisters themselves, if any of them were still alive. I then started reaching out to various other people who knew the band, knew the sisters directly. So Tokyo Happy Coats was a band comprised of five sisters called the Hakamori Sisters, and they were from Tokyo, Japan. The band was first known as the Gay Little Hearts. They played the U.S. military entertainment circuit in East Asia during the 1950s and 60s. They did come to the United States in 1964, where they played the resort and lounge circuit, but by early 1971, they stopped performing. The sisters, from oldest to youngest, the oldest was Eiko, and her main instrument was the accordion. Shoko played tenor saxophone. Keiko played the drums. Tomiko played electric guitar. And Roriko, she was the main vocalist, but she also played electric bass guitar. Now, some of the newspaper articles about the sisters said that their mother was an acrobat. So if true, then you can say that show business was in their DNA. The sisters' first act was an acrobatic comedy troupe. The earliest mention I have of them is in an issue of the Pacific Stars and Stripes in 1953. By 1955, the sisters assembled their band And again, they were called the Gay Little Hearts. From 1955 to 1964, they played mainly on the U.S. military entertainment circuit in East Asia. They would play on Army bases, Air Force bases, Marine Corps bases, and they even played on U.S. Navy ships in that area. Besides Japan, they also played at Okinawa, Taiwan, and the Philippines. As early as 1958, the sisters did attract the attention of a Las Vegas show producer named Tom Ball. And Ball tried to bring the sisters to play in the U.S. in 1959 and 1960. But I can't find any evidence that they came over at that time. But it wasn't until August of 1964 that the sisters finally came to the U.S. Again, Tom Ball and another man named Dan Sawyer was able to bring them over. Dan Sawyer was also the band's general manager here in the U.S. They changed their name at first to the Happy Coats, but then later they changed it again to Tokyo Happy Coats. The sisters sort of adopted a new look as well, and they had these matching black pageboy wigs. And once they came over to the U.S., they did learn to play new instruments. They did learn to play the trombone, trumpet, clarinet, and so forth. And their first venue was at the Desert Inn in Las Vegas. From 1964 to 1971, they played various venues across the U.S. at casinos and resorts, lounges, and supper clubs.
You had talked briefly about the different instruments each sister played, and there was one who handled the lead singing. Her delivery and her cadence was just so smooth that you would never know that English wasn't their first language.
English was a second language to the sisters. Even when in Japan, they knew some English, but they weren't totally fluent in it. The way they learned the English for their songs, I'm assuming that they learned it phonetically. I do know that once they came over to the U.S., they did have a music director. His name was Bob Lloyd. There is a mention of Bob Lloyd. What he would do is that when they would have to learn a new song or something, he would sing it into a tape recorder and tape it. And then the sisters or Ririko would use that in order to learn the lyrics.
When they came here and they started accomplishing things like performing on the Ed Sullivan Show, was there a sense that they picked up on the gravity of it all?
I believe they were aware of cultural significance they were participating in, especially like the Ed Sullivan Show and playing at Las Vegas and playing at Lake Tahoe and Atlantic City and so forth. Because at those times, that would be a really big accomplishment in those days to play at Las Vegas.
Well, if we could go back to their time with King Records and what they recorded there.
In their dealings with King Records, I know in February and March of 1970, they did go to Cincinnati and recorded there at the King Studio. I'm thinking that there they recorded the material for the album Tokyo Happy Coats Live. Later in June of 1970, their first single, Forevermore, and also the aforementioned Tokyo Happy Coats Live album was released. In late June, July 1970, they had a second recording session, but it was at the Starday Studio in Nashville. It is there where I think the material for the Forevermore LP was recorded. Their second single, Here's Happiness, was probably released in November, December 1970. The Forevermore album, I'm a little hazy on when that was actually released. It could have been late 1970. It could have actually been 1971.
Have you gathered any information on why they stopped making music and stopped performing directly after the release of their only LPs?
In an article in the Honolulu Advertiser, this was in February of 1971, there was a one or two sentence mention that the Tokyo Happy Coats had disbanded. So I believe that all five sisters were married at that point. And so I think they wanted to stop and begin their own lives with their husbands and whatnot. But then you got to remember that they were on the road for most of the year at different venues. Some venues would be a couple days to a couple weeks. And the nights that they were doing a show, they would play 2 to 3 shows. Plus, they had all of their instruments and all of their props and all of their costumes. So you can imagine going across the country like that. And by that point, they had performed together for 16 years, and they just decided to end it.
How would you describe Tokyo Happy Coat's music?
I would describe their music as a unique take on American music because they played so many different genres. They played rock, jazz, soul music, country. There were a couple rockabilly numbers. 2 songs sort of stand out to me with their King Records material. The first song is The Beat Goes On, which is on the live album. To do that song with horns, shoko saxophone, and then in the middle of it, you have this very awesome drum solo by Keiko. It's rather short, but you could tell the talent that they had, and that's one of the songs. The other song I like, it's on the 2nd album, Forevermore. It's Uptight, their version of the Stevie Wonder song. Again, incorporating saxophone. And then at the end, I think it was hand clapping and finger snapping, you know, to integrate that into their take on this classic Motown song. I thought it was unique.
What's the most fascinating thing you've learned about the band in your time researching them?
One of the most interesting things I found out is September 9th, 1965, they went to Nashville and recorded 3 songs for Columbia Records. They did it at the Columbia Records' famous Studio B, which is known as the Quonset Hut Studio. I don't have the purpose of why they recorded there, what the reasons were, but in my mind's eye, to have these 5 sisters from Tokyo, Japan, come to Nashville and record in the same studio that Patsy Cline, Bob Dylan, Johnny Cash, and I just find it fascinating.
Do you know if any of the members are still alive?
I think some of the sisters are still alive. I have not officially contacted any of them yet. I have some leads. I have an idea that 4 to 5 are still living. The 5th one, I can't get a handle on. I've been pursuing some leads, but I haven't actually officially contacted any of them yet.
This has been an interview with Roy Bauger, who has spent the past few years researching the Tokyo Happy Coats, an unsung band from Japan who released their only 2 LPs with King Records in 1970. I'm Dellen Stokesbury for WVXU.
My guests this evening are KJ Sanchez, playwright and director, and music director Richard Huntley, who are here to work on Cincinnati King, which is opening on November 8th at the Cincinnati Playhouse's Shelter House Theater through December 23rd. It's the story of Cincinnati's legendary King Records, and especially its colorful founder, Sid Nathan. You've both been working on this show for some time now. I wonder if you could fill our listeners in a little bit on where it came from. How did this get started?
Right. We have been working on this for a while. We've been working on it for 5 years. Blake, the artistic director at Cincinnati Playhouse in the Park, and I have worked together for many years. And when he took over as artistic director, he called me up and said, I'm wondering if you and your theater company, American Records, would be interested in working with Cincinnati Playhouse in the Park. Over the course of the last 15 years, I've made about 15 documentary plays based on interviews with real people about real subjects. And I said, yes, sure. I came to visit Cincinnati the first time and totally fell in love with the city. So Blake canvassed some of his staff and some of his associates and audience members about what is the story that is uniquely Cincinnati, and everybody said King Records.
Mm-hmm. Did either of you know about King Records before this?
I had known about it sort of peripherally, just in terms of Tiny Bradshaw, Little Willie John, some of the bigger artists. But once I started digging and doing research, I was blown away by the incredible music, musicians, all the stories.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't just the two of you doing research on this.
No, no. To begin with, we created a, quote, story corps, a group of people who are conducting interviews. So that first year, we had about seven folks who were a combination of staff, associate artists, board members, who went out and interviewed various people. And then I had a big pile of interviews. And originally, I thought that this was going to be a documentary play. And the way a documentary play works is the people that I interviewed become characters in the play. All the dialogue comes straight from these transcripts. And they talk to the audience as if the audience is interviewing them. But 4 years ago, we did a celebration to honor Philip Paul's birthday and the anniversary of King Records in Washington Park. And it was then that Rich and his brother Ralph Huntley, who's a professional musician from Portland, Oregon, came down, and we decided to do some samples of the transcripts that we had all conducted and intersplice some of our favorite songs from the King catalog. And it was there when we watched the audience listening to these stories with the music that we realized that it actually wanted to be a musical.
Mm-hmm. Right. It was almost like a radio play with a concert.
Talk a little bit about Philip Paul, because I know that you use him as a character in this. And some of our listeners, although he lives here in Cincinnati, may not know who he is.
So Philip Paul was born and raised in Spanish Harlem in New York, and was an up-and-coming rising star in the jazz world in New York City, played with
Charlie Parker, he played with Dizzy Gillespie, Bud Powell,
all the names.
Right.
Tiny Bradshaw needed a new drummer, and Tiny Bradshaw was recording here in Cincinnati and getting ready to go out on the road. And so he called Philip up and said, do you want to come to Cincinnati? And so Philip got on a Greyhound bus. In fact, we took he and his new bride of 3 years, Bobby, to dinner the other night, and we were driving past the Greyhound station, and he said, that's where I arrived in Cincinnati
with my drums.
And Philip Paul was the studio drummer, and so I started by interviewing him.
Well, he must have an encyclopedic knowledge and familiarity with all of this. And he's not literally in the show. You have an actor playing him
We have an actor playing him, Stanley Mathis, who's been in many Broadway shows. He was in The Lion King. He was in Book of Mormon. And it's funny because he came in and we cast him as Philip Paul, and Philip Paul, the character, doesn't actually sing. But now that we know we have this incredible singer, we might have him do a Hank Ballard tune. Yeah, Stanley's going to be great. And he's a little bit younger than Mr. Paul, because the play goes back in time and we see some scenes with a younger Mr. Paul. Now, where this jukebox docu mashup comes from, we're inventing, I think, a new genre with this piece. There are three parts to it. It's one part, all of the incredible songs from the King catalog.
Not just Little Willie John and Tiny Bradshaw, also Delmore Brothers, Lonnie Johnson, Lula Reed, Ernestine Ellen, Freddie King. So we're trying to cover the breadth and variety of music that
Moon Mulligan, the Delmore Brothers. Right. So we also have some country tunes in there as well.
Because all of that music was recorded at King Records.
Absolutely.
Right. Yeah. And so that's one of the three parts. The other part is the character of Philip Paul, who is our narrator. And all of that dialogue came straight from the transcripts with Mr. Paul. The third part is actually fiction, and it's scenes based on what I know about Little Willie John and Sid Nathan. We were lucky enough to have a lot of recordings of Sid Nathan because he was such a control freak that he actually made records of himself talking to his staff.
Really funny and instructive.
They're hilarious, too, because he's got this bravura, he's got this huge ego, but he also actually is really funny, and he knows he's really funny in these recordings. And I would go on long runs listening to his voice. So as I started to write these fictional scenes, basically the ghosts of Sid Nathan and Little Willie John bust in and decide that they also need to be interviewed by me.
So you have actors playing both of those roles.
That's
also
right.
Then, you know, there's a lot of talk about King Records locally because this, in fact, is the 75th anniversary this year of the studio being established here. And a lot has been going on. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about why it happened here and why it's important to pop music in America.
Yeah, I think it happened here because you had recording artists that were doing what was then called Hillbilly Records. Mm-hmm. And what was called Race Records of the time, all coming through Cincinnati. And Sid was such a genius because he knew that he could grab these folks, offer them a little extra cash to go into his studio renting Herzog for a while until he created his own studio.
Cut a quick side, and he had the wherewithal to figure out how to press records and distribute records so he could cut a side. 24 hours later, the record would be out.
And they distribute them in grocery stores and gas stations.
Right. I think one of the most fascinating aspects of King to me is that in that era, you had a multiracial studio band. So you had musicians of different colors playing together and playing all kinds of music.
Yeah. And one of the great recording artists of King Records that we think hasn't gotten his due is Little Willie John, who was the first to sing Fever. One of the finest recording artists, performers to have ever lived. He's not a household name because he died in prison at the age of 30, wrongfully accused of murder. And even his prosecutor later said, I don't think he should have been given murder. It was self-defense. And that was clear to everybody. And this is the guy who prosecuted the case.
Well, this is really some fascinating history, and it all happened here in Cincinnati, so right. That makes it all the more fun. Cincinnati King is history, but it's also entertainment. After all, it is one of the Playhouse's holiday shows this
season. It's actually very funny.
Yeah. How many songs altogether?
17 in total.
Titles that you can mention that people might be aware of?
Fever, All Around the World, Leave My Kitten Alone, The Twist, Delmore Brothers Blues Stay Away, the Lonnie Johnson version of Delmore Brothers Blues Stay Away, Drown in My Own Tears, as sung by Lula Reed, and many other great tunes.
Welcome to the Club, Anastine Allen. Oh man, we've got some great singers. Anita Walsh, who's singing the Anastine Allen and Lulu Reed tunes. She is incredible.
Yeah. Well, this is going to be a wonderful month and a half or so at the Playhouse. Cincinnati King opens on November 8th at the Cincinnati Playhouse's Shelter House Theater. It's on stage through December 23rd. For more information about the show, look for the link at wvxu.org/aroundcincinnati. I've been talking with KJ Sanchez and Richard Huntley, the folks who pulled all of this wonderful entertainment together for us, and we will certainly be looking for it later this year. Thanks for taking the time for this conversation.
It was a real pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
For WVXU, I'm Rick Pender.
Get a feeling that's so hard to bear. You give me fever when you kiss me, fever when you hold me tight, fever in the morning, fever all through the night. Listen to me, baby, hear every word I say. They don't know how to love you my way. You give me fever when you kiss me, fever when you hold me tight, fever in the morning and fever all through
just believing what my lips have to say. You give me fever when you kiss me, fever when you hold me tight. Treat me right, you give me fever when you kiss me, fever when you hold me tight. Fever in the morning, fever all through the night.
Have Darren Blaze here. Darren Blaze from Shake It Records. Darren runs the place with his brother Jim. Let's talk about King Records. How did you get involved in this?
I stumbled across it. I remember it was a Hank Ballard Jukebox Hits LP. And I was in high school. I think I was about 14 at the time. And, you know, I'd get paid on Friday. And then Friday night, I would go to the record store and buy records. My brother probably drove me out. And I was flipping through the bins and I saw Hank Ballard 24 Jukebox Hits LP. And I didn't know who Hank Ballard was. Probably didn't even know that he had done the original version of The Twist at that point or whatever. For some reason, I just picked it up and I flipped it over and I'm reading it and I see Cincinnati, Ohio on it. And it was just kind of like, what? I thought all records either had to be made in New York or LA. And that's it. There's nothing in between, you know, like the flyover states of making records or something like that. So I took it home and I was like, wow, this is pretty cool. You know, back then I was, you know, into punk rock and all that kind of stuff. And I was like, there's a rough edge to it, a little unproduced, a little gritty. So it kind of like, you know, warmed up to my ears and stuff like that. And that just kind of started this ridiculous thing where, you know, 35 years later, I'm still doing house calls and going out and seeking oddball Cincinnati records that I've never seen. And probably every week I come across something that I haven't seen. There was so much stuff that was manufactured in Cincinnati. All these little micro and cottage industries sprung out of King. So many of these guys, whether it was like Burkhardt, who owned Wright Records, or, you know, Shaw, who owned Shaw Pressing over on Dana and up in Clifton. All these guys at one point worked for King. And then for one reason or another, got tired of Sid's gruff personality. Sid Nathan, the owner of King, you know, he knew what he was doing, but it was also a little hard to get along with. So some people maybe grew tired of that and started their own thing. So there's all these like little micro labels and pressing companies. And there's just this plethora of just like one-off records in Cincinnati of like one guy's pipe dream or one girl's pipe dream. Like, I'm going to make it big. Here's my record. And, you know, like if you go on eBay, Ohio is one of the few states that gets keyworded in like 45 searches just because there were so many pressing plants here. And a lot of that came from King, you know, that we had Wright Records and QCA and Shaw and all those guys were pressing up records. And anybody that would come in with a tape, they'd make you a record.
One of the things to mention, too, is that Cincinnati records didn't have a specific sound. No. If you think of Detroit and Motown, there's that. You think of Philadelphia Soul, there was, you know, all those groups, even with
Chicago
different labels.
Blues and all that kind of stuff.
But Cincinnati, you think of R&B. You can also think of country, for that matter.
Yeah, exactly. And I think King Records kind of becomes synonymous with Cincinnati. But when you want to talk about a Cincinnati sound, if there is a Cincinnati sound, the sound is Lonnie Mack, which is a little bit of country, some soul, R&B, all kind of thrown together. And it's just kind of a reflection of a river town. A lot of ideas floating around and a little bit of this, a little bit of that. You know, and then Lonnie, he did a lot of session work at King, but he recorded under his own name for Fraternity. But it was Fraternity that probably issued more local records from people than King. King was much more national, although King had some local artists and some, you know, Otis Williams and Cody Black and some of the early WLW talent. You know, and then you get into the historical aspect of things and its place in American pop culture and racial understandings. And I've always kind of found it interesting of why we always look toward like Procter & Gamble and Kroger and these kinds of companies that get lauded in the business community as these great benchmarks and blue chip companies in Cincinnati. But King was just as revolutionary in kind of how they went about doing everything. They were the first totally one-stop, do-it-all-under-one-roof company in the United States. I remember once I had the opportunity to interview Bill Doggett, who was an organ player, like jazz organ.
Honky Tonk.
Yeah, Honky Tonk, which is probably the biggest selling song on King.
Parts 1 and 2.
Oh my God. It's a rite of passage for any bar band to learn still to this day, I think. They were out on tour, and we were talking about how Sid went about his business, and Bill was sharing the story with me. Like, they were out on tour. They came in and did a small, you know, run of shows here in Cincinnati, and while they were here, they went to King to do some recording sessions. And he said they did the recording sessions probably on a Monday or a Tuesday, and then they played a couple shows, and then they did a show in Indianapolis, and they went to Chicago the weekend and then had a couple shows up there. That following Tuesday, 7 days later, two of the songs that they had recorded were in a record store bin a week later, which is just incredible. There was no other company that could react that fast to the market. So if King had a hit, it had the ability to stay up on the hit. Whereas with a lot of other companies, they were relying on other pressing companies, you know, and if you were a little independent, couldn't get your foot in the door enough, you had to stand in line behind the Mercurys and the Columbias and get all their stuff done, and then they would do your record. Whereas King, with an independent, they just were able to make it a priority, keep forcing them out. So when Honky Tonk hits, they're pressing millions of those. And that's why very few people had contemporary hits on King recording artists, because the majors couldn't beat the turnaround with them. So you had people that did, there weren't simultaneous hits. Little Willie John has a hit with Fever, but it's years after that Peggy Lee has the hit with Fever. And I think that's just as interesting from a business standpoint. I would like to see that taught in a business class at UC just as much as, you know, Ivory Soap or whatever, how that was kind of like stumbled across. So
I've never heard anyone compare King Records to P&G like
that.
There
you go. Welcome to my world.
Well, let's talk about your world for a minute here, because, you know, you're talking about hearing a Hank Ballard record, and from there, you're like the historian on King Records and all the artists and the production and everything, and you can talk about pressing records. Mm-hmm. You've got a lot going on with this.
Well, you know, I was lucky enough to, like, be able to go interview a lot of these guys when they are still around. You know, when I go through my, like, cassettes at home, I'm like, well, Jim Wilson's gone, this guy's gone, this guy's gone, Cody Black's gone. So I was young enough, I was at an age where probably by my freshman year in college, from working in record shops, I worked at Moles Records, and H-Bomb Ferguson would come in. And so when I got to know these guys, I was able to sit and interview H-Bomb or Big Joe or Pigmeat Jarrett or Roosevelt Lee, and I was able to kind of like navigate that world through the help of like, oh, you should talk to this person and you should talk to this person. And so if they had interesting pictures and stuff like that, I was always able to get scans, because I mean, who knows, shoe boxes get lost. And you know, we go on these house calls and the stuff that is on the way to the dump sometimes is truly incredible, like historically important stuff.
You know, we're talking photographs.
Photographs, legal documents. I mean, tons of contracts. I have an entire dossier of legal contracts through Musicians Local One, which was the African Americans Musician Union that was in Cincinnati, that are just grievances filed with theaters in the South who weren't paying the full amount of guarantees and stuff like that. And it's artists like Hank Ballard, Billy Ward, and the Dominoes. And a lot of them were like King artists. I guess they were filed through here.
Now, of course, if we were talking about Bob Dylan or the Beatles, you could publish this stuff as a big book and it would sell thousands and thousands of copies.
Sure. But I think I've always found that, you know, here's a little business card here. Here's a receipt from the recording session over here. Here's a promotional photo here. Here's a contract here. Here's their WCKY, you know, whatever, blah, 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 here. And then you start putting all that stuff together and it starts to tell the story of these artists and the music scene in Cincinnati from the 1930s through the present day. What is in the bottom of boxes sometimes is truly incredible. I've found like napkins from the Cotton Club, and I'll buy the napkin. I don't need any of their records, but I'll buy the napkin from the Cotton Club. You know, I'll give you $10 for that, you know, and then I just put it in a file. So, you know, one of the projects that we're working on at the store at Shake It is kind of creating a space where we can start to display a lot of the stuff that we've been saving for years. And now I have a lot of friends throughout the country, and they'll take a picture of something and say, hey, I'm at an antique mall in Durham, South Carolina. Is this something that you want? 3 or 4 months ago, someone sent me the cover of the Augusta Journal the day after James Brown died. It was $4. It costs more to ship it. You know, I don't know what I'm going to do with it. It's sitting on a table in the basement at the store, so I'll take that. Or a friend of mine was in Erie, Pennsylvania at a swap meet, and he sent me a couple pictures of things, and he said, do you know who these people are? And a couple of the pictures are like these old-timey, like Polaroids of Bonnie Lou and Louie Ennis at a record show in Nashville in the King Records booth. And they were $5 a sheet. And they were just filled with all these old country artists. And I said, just offer them this much for the box. Then I get them back. And it's pictures of Jerry Bird, and it's pictures of Louie Ennis, and it's pictures of Zeb Turner, Homer and Jethro, Bonnie Lou, Red Turner, you know, all these early like WLW and King artists. It was somebody's scrapbook or something. I have no idea.
You mentioned Bonnie Lou in particular, mm-hmm. and I remember her from being, she was on TV for years and years on WLW.
I remember her because my parents bought a couch at Oakham's Furniture in Cheviot, and I remember her.
Yeah, see, the thing that's really amazing is the, I think the connection, the overlapping between the Cincinnati radio stations mm-hmm. over the years and the local King Records yeah. and other labels yeah. too. I mean, that didn't happen in every city.
No, Nashville had the Grand Ole Opry, but until Bullitt Records came along, there wasn't really a record company in Nashville that was taking advantage of this radio talent. In Cincinnati, we had WLW and WCKY, who had the Boone County Jamboree and the Midwestern Hayride. And for Sid at that time, who owned a record store around the corner on Central Avenue, right down the street from where we're standing right now, it was kind of like low-hanging fruit. Like, he saw the popularity of these guys on the radio, so why not record them and sell records too? I mean, he had a little record shop was in the back, and his record shop kind of like straddled the West End, and, you know, it was kind of like the white neighborhood and the black neighborhood, and so he kind of was kind of in the middle there. So he was able to sell a little bit of records to everybody, and he was able to strike up these deals, sometimes because of contracts with WLW, they weren't allowed to record under their own names, so like Grandpa Jones and Merle Travis recorded under like the Shepherd Brothers. But, you know, you let the word leak out on who it is and then they'll sell. You know, but that's like the Delmore Brothers and Wayne Rainey. And, you know, it's just one after the other of all these Midwestern Hayride talent that ended up on King because the A&R work and the PR work was already being done. You know, these guys were on national radio. All he had to do was make the records and sell them. So. And it seemed to work out pretty well.
Must have been an amazing time back then.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I just find it endlessly fascinating on like how all that stuff kind of fell together. But even more so now, I like hearing the stories of, I don't really care about hearing anything more about James Brown, you know? But I like Ann Jones or people that made one record and kind of disappeared and like came back and made another record. And Junior McCants, I find endlessly fascinating. Some of his family's like still around. And then there's guys that I can remember, you know, I remember seeing Pig Meat Jarrett on Thursday nights at Corey's and going to see him. I don't know, maybe I'm just like an old soul or something like that, but going to see those guys, you just kind of realize that when they're gone, that's gone. There's not going to be another Pigmeat Jarrett, and there's never going to be another H-Bomb Ferguson. You know, so for some reason, there's just something inside of me that said, I should see these guys as much as I can while I can. And so I'm glad that I did.
You're sitting here talking about musicians, recording artists, mm-hmm. that the vast majority of people listening this right now mm-hmm. have never heard of. You know, maybe 95% of mm-hmm. the names that you mentioned, mm-hmm. people have no idea yeah. who you're talking yeah. about. Yeah. So, okay. That is kind of what your project that you're mm-hmm. doing right now mm-hmm. is trying to rectify that, mm-hmm. to bring out these names, these artists, these mm-hmm. talents, and kind of expose them to light for probably the first time in 50, 60 mm-hmm. years, if yeah. not more. Yeah. So let's talk about what you're up to. You've got all this material you've been collecting over the years. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about what you're doing with all of it now.
Well, I think it'll just be a space in the store that's dedicated to some of that collection and the holdings and stuff like that. But there's enough of it now where if it's Lonnie Mack's birthday, we can do a display on Lonnie Mack. If it's the anniversary of the Funky Drummer, we can do a display on the Funky Drummer and like do a display of all the other records that have been sampled that feature the Funky Drummer in it. Or we could just do a Midwestern Hayride display, or we can do a Kodee Black display. You know, so we'll probably work around like birthdays and anniversaries. You know, we'll do themes.
So you've actually got a space in the basement of Shake It Records?
Yeah, we have a carpenter now, finishing carpenter, building it out. And it'll probably be up maybe November or something like that we're shooting for.
We've been here with Darren Blaze from Shake It Records, who's a big-time expert on the Cincinnati music scene, not just from today, but from all in the past. So, Darren, thank you so very much for coming in and telling us about what's going on. All your exhibits at Shake It Records, all your work with the history of Cincinnati music. It's been appreciated by so many of us over the years.
Thanks, Frank.
I'm Frank Johnson for WVXU.
This year is the 75th anniversary of King Records, which has been given much-needed attention the past few years from the city of Cincinnati. With me in the studio is Tim Reardon, who's on the board of King Studios and is former assistant city manager for the city of Cincinnati. Welcome to WVXU, Tim.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Let's start with your involvement with King Records, before or after working with the city.
All my efforts have been after the city. I think I really learned about King Records after I'd left the city. And what I learned was that there's this amazing story. It's both a sociological story and a music story. What was fascinating to me is in 1948, this organization was totally integrated. It sort of blasted out Jim Crow. It hired blacks and whites. It had people at all levels in the organization. It even right after the war, it had a Japanese and a Chinese person there. I mean, to me, this is really an outstanding statement about something going on in Cincinnati. And I think this heritage, along with the music heritage, needs to be remembered.
And the timeline that I've put together says that the original studio of King Records is located at 1540 Brewster Avenue in Evanston, which you can see real easily from I-71. And there's a historic marker in front of the studios put there by the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2008. And then in 2015, the building received an historical designation by the city to stop demolition, and the city changed the zoning to also help stop the demolition process. And then in 2016, the Ohio Supreme Court heard arguments from the owner, Dynamic Industries. And in 2017, the eminent domain process was started by the city. Where are we now?
Well, what's happened is it's come to a peaceable and good ending. The city and the owner of the building did an exchange of property, so the city now owns one of the two King Records buildings, so it worked out very, very well. it was a very amenable solution. And that's really great because as you go forward, we've always talked about wanting to do something with King Records, but if you don't own the building, you're just sort of selling vapor, you know? And so now we got the building. There's a lot of work to do. The building is in awful condition. The city does have some money set aside. It needs a new roof so the vegetable garden doesn't grow inside anymore. And I believe the city will be doing that hopefully yet this year.
There's a Clean the King picnic planned during September. I think it's September 15th. And they're asking folks from the community to come out and help clean around the building.
Right. And that'll be a good effort. Inside the building, you know, they found some asbestos. So, you know, that's all got to be done by the proper people. But outside the building, they can do that and, you know, just feel like, hey, we're a little bit a part of this. And I guess I should mention, really, September is King Records month. So there's a series of, I don't know, 25 or 30 things, I think, that are going to be going on, helping people remember and know about the wonderful heritage of King Records.
And you're on the board of King Studios. What's that group doing?
Well, doing a couple of things. Number one is it created the Traveling Suitcase. And what they did is it's a program that all ties into the state of Ohio objectives and the testing requirements. And so teachers can take out a suitcase, just like the musicians used to travel around carrying suitcases, and they can then do a lesson in math, science, history, music, and kids will learn about the regular things they have to know about, the skills, plus they'll learn about King Records and what it did for Cincinnati. In addition, you know, we've put together a series of panels that each year have been displayed during September at the Freedom Center. And these panels, there's a total of 30 of them, will then be on display at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. It's 30 panels. It'll be from January through June of 2019. Rock and Roll Hall of Fame people have always been interested in King Records and its contribution to the American music scene.
And what are the plans for the building?
Well, we want to make it some kind of an active center with something that also shows what the history was and explain that history. I think really the next step, and we're in discussions about this, but I think the next step is probably to try to get a museum planning firm, and there are several of those in Ohio, and get them to come and work, build a master plan. What should we do? What's viable? What's not viable? And I think it's very important if we go out to raise money to, you know, make those improvements and make this kind of a museum and an activity center. It also has to be sustainable. Anybody that's going to donate any money to this wants to know that, all right, you've got a plan for operating this facility into the future.
And also, there are still musicians alive who know what the inside of that building, what the studios look like. I would think they would be a great help with the planners.
Oh, right. I think you're going to want to talk to everybody, particularly those people that can tell you, well, this was here, that was there. One of Sid's nephews is a member of our board at King Studios, and I think Sid died in, Sid Nathan was the guy that was the owner of King Records. I think he died in 1968. And Steve was 18 when Sid died, so Steve also knows some of the stories and some of the locations. But I think, yeah, all of those people will be very helpful in to any kind of a museum designer and planner.
Are you working on any particular parts of the King Studios projects?
Well, I did a little bit of work with the guys who are working on the panels that will be going up. And then I've been trying to do some preliminary work to get us ready to do some fundraising at some point. I think we need to be further along in the planning before we go out and do that, have a good, well-done, reputable national plan, and also to have a sustainability plan, how are we going to keep doing it. And then I'd like to participate in the fundraising.
And how is King Studios and the Brewster location working with the Evanston community?
Well, the chairman of our group is also the head of the Evanston community.
Oh, well, there we are. We have the tie-in with community, which I would assume would mean that there's a direct link with a lot of the young people who are in the area.
I think that's always been one of the things that we've talked about, is to introduce the young people to this type of a facility, this type of history. So it's always been talked about as a facility that would be active, and hopefully with things for the kids to be able to do and learn about and understand and participate in music.
Thanks for all you're doing to help save the legacy of King Records, Tim.
Oh, it's been great. It's a labor of love.
I've been speaking with Tim Reardon, who is on the board of King Studios. You'll find a link to King Studios' Facebook page at WVXU.org. The Cincinnati Preservation Association plays a significant role in saving Cincinnati's landmark historic buildings. One of the buildings, which will be highlighted at their Fall Forum luncheon on October 26th in Hilton Netherland Plaza's Hall of Mirrors, is the King Records Studio on Brewster Avenue. With me in the studio to talk about this event is the director of the Cincinnati Preservation Association, Paul Muller. Thanks for coming in tonight.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So tell us about CPA's efforts to help save the King Building on Brewster, and who have you been working with to save the King Building?
Well, we consider it a real honor to be able to help with this project. It's been carried forward by so many people, cutting across the community people in Evanston to the musicians who perform there, just people who care about the history of culture and the people at Xavier University. We are helping right now with the National Historic Register nomination, which will help pave the way for historic tax credits if they take that approach to redeveloping the building.
And what does that effort involve?
Well, for the National Historic Register, you have to put it in a category. Either it's a significant architecture or it's made a significant contribution to a cultural aspect. And King definitely qualifies in that, probably at a national level of significance. And fortunately, we're getting help from some music historians from Nashville who came up on their own to join some of the meetings and just said, this is extremely important. These are people who wrote National Register nominations for the Ryman Auditorium and for a lot of really significant buildings in the history of music in America. And they're adding a lot of really good context to the important role King played.
Well, there is a definite tie between the King Records musicians and the Grand Ole Opry, that's for sure.
Yeah, one dimension of them. And that's what's so great about King. It cuts through so many dimensions of American music and became this sort of cauldron for bringing together rhythm and blues and what was called hillbilly music at the time. And that bouncing the music, even some of the same songs back and forth between those genres, ended up being a wonderful percolating situation for what turned into so many different strands of American music.
In the press release that CPA sent out, and I quote, "This year we are focusing on the bigger picture that preservation plays in our culture." How does this message relate to saving the King Records building in Evanston?
Well, the preservation movement started by saving landmarks. You can trace it to the Mount Vernon Ladies Association in the 1850s when they said the president's house needs to be saved. Since then, it's moved to looking at a bigger picture of what makes our built environment and what's important about that. So it moves beyond bricks and mortar at some point, and you're talking about the culture and the life that occurred within historic buildings. So King's a perfect example of that. The building's fine. It's a little industrial building that Sid Nathan got to run his company in. But the real significance of it is what happened there. And so as Cincinnati Preservation Association, we've been focused on doing partnerships with everyone we can in every dimension. And this is a one we're really grateful to be able to help with.
And I think it's also important that the next generations know the heritage of certain buildings and certain cultural institutions in the area.
Yeah, that's a great point, Lee. With the pace of change increasing, society is just churning through things so rapidly. To be able to go back to the roots of something that came from people responding to what was around them and creating art about that, having some anchors that are inclusive, that cover a lot of different socioeconomic and racial groups, is really important to us now.
The keynote speaker of your fall forum luncheon is Terry Stewart, former director of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland, who came down to Cincinnati for the unveiling of the historic marker that's now in front of the King Building on Brewster. Tell us about his part in all this and Margaret Valentine's role.
Well, Margaret Valentine is the chair of our fall forum. She's been leading this for probably about 12 years, maybe. And one of her concepts was to expand the bounds of preservation with a very serious, high-level lecture series every year. We do it on a Friday afternoon in late October. This year, it's October 26. And the speakers have really pushed the bounds of it. We had someone on walkable cities a couple of years ago. We've had on the economics of preservation. This is the first time we've connected it to a specific project. But she thought King was important, and that she wanted to bring the spotlight of this. We get about 300 to 400 people in the Hall of Mirrors. It's a very concise event. It starts right at 12, and we get people out by 1:15, although they seem to stay around and talk to each other for another half an hour, which we really like.
And what's on the agenda for the luncheon?
Well, as I said, it's very straightforward. We don't do a lot of extra talking. Margaret Valentine got Dion Brown to be the introductory speaker to introduce Terry Stewart. And he's the president and CEO of the Underground Railroad Freedom Center, somewhat new to town. So we like the idea of having him there. But what's really nice about it is he had previously founded the Blues Museum in St. Louis. So he has a long history of interpreting music. And so we think it'll be a great introduction to Terry Stewart.
And he also headed up the B.B. King Museum down in Mississippi. He's very well-versed in the blues, and I think he's an apt student of Cincinnati's history of music, especially King Records.
Yeah, we're very fortunate to get him for the introduction.
What can local Cincinnatians do to help save the Brewster King Building and support the CPA's efforts in that?
Well, I think they can connect with the King Studios organization that's doing a great job of pulling together a broad coalition of people to support it. And if they'd like to come to our fall forum, Terry Stewart, he's very passionate about the importance of King. It's one thing for us to go around in Cincinnati saying this is really important to the history of the development of rock and roll and many other genres. But Terry comes in and says it from a position of real authority.
And what do you think the future holds for the building and CPA's role in its preservation?
Our role in it, I think, is small compared to all the groups that are doing the work, the musicians that perform there, and the people in Evanston who are coming together around this. But I think it's a bright future because, first of all, the city now owns the building. They're going to be stabilizing it, putting a new roof on, and people are still working out exactly what the programming and function of the building will be. But it looks to me like it's a very methodical process. I think they'll come up with a really great community-based use.
Thank you so much for helping to save this iconic part of Cincinnati's musical heritage.
Well, thank you.
I've been speaking with Paul Muller, director of the Cincinnati Preservation Association, about King Records and their Fall Forum Luncheon on Friday, October 26th at the Hall of Mirrors in the Hilton Netherland Plaza. You've been listening to a special in honor of the 75th anniversary of King Records with a potpourri of topics. You'll find more information about King Records at WBXU.org. This is 91.7 WBXU Cincinnati and 88.5 WMUB Oxford. I'm producer and host Lee Hay.